are now listening to New Models. Nobody knows what it actually is.
It's like air or water.
Only the more you drink, the thirstier you get.
Wherever it came from, it don't belong here.
Is it us or is it something else?
It's content today with Carly Busta and Lil Internet.
Anywhere else.
Only on New Models.
Welcome to New Models, this is Content Today. If the official stats can be trusted, 3,733 registered journalists attended the pre-opening of this year's Venice Art Biennale, a group that is projected to produce some 2,500 pieces of legacy media-style coverage. Nobody needs a New Models take on the Venice Biennale, not even the Biennale, who, for the record, did not issue us press access. Fortunately, we did see the show, and we have thoughts, opinions even, and we're bringing them to you here. This episode is kind of a teaser, a rapid roundup of what we could see while chaperoned by an almost three-year-old, because later this month we'll be posting a longer-form rundown on our primary reason for being in Venice this year, an installation we made together with artist and host of the Doom Scroll podcast Joshua Citarella for the exhibition Strange Rules, curated by Holly Herndon, Matt Dryhurst, and Hans-Ulrich Obrist, with Adriana Rispoli at Berggruen Arts and Culture's Palazzo Diedo. But for now, here's some content today, plus a bonus travel section detailing 48 hours in a Nazi-haunted enclave of Italy's Lake Garda. I'm Lil Internet, joined by my co-host Carly Busta. Let's get into it. Okay.
All right, we're back. Literally,
yeah, like
back
really,
in Berlin.
Really, really back because we were not here.
We've been in Venice. I have to just start by saying that we have some friends coming over for dinner tonight, and we started making carnitas at like 1 p.m. Thank you, Nick Hood, for the recipe. And it's like melting my brain. I kind of can't think about anything except for these carnitas right now. So I'm like, 10% of my brain is dedicated to what is happening on the stove. I'm sorry.
I think that, it's like intoxicating. It does something to your head.
It does. Maybe it's like the pig spirit, like haunting me.
I feel pig-like in my brain.
Me too.
I feel slow and rotund. And I feel like laying down in some mud.
Well, in part, I think we can attribute that to being in Venice, along with a lot of other people for the past couple weeks.
But why were we in Venice?
Because we did an installation with Joshua Citarella at the Palazzo Diedo for an exhibition titled Strange Rules, which was curated by Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst with Hans-Ulrich Obrist and Adriana Rispoli. A lot of amazing people in the show. Of course, Matt and Holly also had a piece. Sub created the infrastructure that made the ideas like travel really well. Simon Denny is in the show, Trevor Paglin, Philippe Perino, Ion Kim, Tara Zero.
Lorenzo Senni also in the show, which I didn't realize until like the day we all were speaking, but actually,
say who he is.
Lorenzo Senni is this electronic music producer from Italy, but he famously, I remember, I think it was like the first time or one of the first times I ever went to Berghain, he was playing. And he played like, I don't know, an hour and a half set that was like only build-ups from like early 2000s trance tracks. Like these epic trance arpeggios, and he has very good taste in trance arpeggios. And then like right when it was about to drop, it would drop into another buildup for like at 90 minutes or something.
And like I was, Shepherd's Tone cubed.
Yes, I was in heaven as a trance arpeggio aficionado myself. Veracocha Carte Blanche, best trance arpeggio ever written. Uh, But Lorenzo Senni kind of turned this into an original, I mean, it is literally protocol art, writing kind of perfect trance arpeggios that just build and don't ever drop.
It's like gooning of trance.
Edging.
Edging of trance.
He has a background in like hardcore punk and only was like ambiently connected to electronic music or like raves or anything, which I think actually really helped his practice because he could kind of approach it from this like pure, naive state, right?
Where
there's none of the subcultural hierarchy or baggage or rules or what's cool, what's not. You can just engage with it with pure openness. And so he ended up...
So what was his piece for this show?
I actually don't know. No, I only know that he was... Also, the thing is, it was so crazy, the schedule, that like...
It is true. Like we got there and like I felt like every single second was accounted for. And I mean, there are also parts of the show that I didn't even see. So luckily we'll be back in October, I think. So we'll be able to see it in full. But
yes. Yeah, we'll be able to see the show we were part of 4 months after it opened. But yes.
But yeah, great lineup. Also, Lawrence Abu Hamdan, who was long working with Forensic Architecture, and Stan Lee, who did Pick Breeder, and Michael Levin, whose Worms were like the poster child for the show. I think Tufts University is where he's working.
Yeah, it's Tufts, I'm pretty sure.
Right. He figured out some years ago that if you change, I guess, like the electrical
charge of... It's about
this
like bio, like the morphology of bodies, like how the cells know how to organize into a hand. I think that was always a little bit of a mystery. And I guess Michael Levin found out that there's like this bioelectric morphological field where it's like these like electrical gradients and cascades of, I don't know, differences in charge and affinities or whatever. I'm just saying words that sound like this is the right way to describe it. But
a really simple organism like a flatworm, and you change the bioelectrical charge of the solution that it's living in, you can get the cells to develop differently. Specifically, he figured out how to make a flatworm develop a second head, so that same body has two heads. But fascinatingly,
this is where it gets really woo-woo,
is that when those biheaded worms, Janus-headed worms, when they reproduce, they have babies that also have two heads.
Without the genes, without the DNA being changed.
So it's a really interesting example of how life is downstream of a set of rules. And of course, if you extrapolate that out, you can think of the platforms that form us as subjects, the protocols of those platforms are shaping us as subjects. You know, you've heard us say a lot of times on this podcast how the creative agency has moved from the content layer, the painting, the sculpture, the song, to the protocol layer. You know, the forms of distribution of the song, the guidelines, the rules that allow that piece of content to circulate. And so that was the thesis of the show. Protocol art. Art is now happening on the protocol layer. And then there is a number of artists that are exploring that.
You know what else she says now? She says, it doesn't matter all the time.
Really?
Yeah. She's saying it's cool. It doesn't matter. Is that what you say?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Okay, full disclosure.
We're back again.
We're recording this with our toddler running around trying to potty train.
Matryoshka doll of we're back.
Totally. But actually, we just paused because we were just speaking with Brandon Rosenbluth, who's putting on the Indigo Festival in Ljubljana in October. That festival is going to be so sick. I'm so excited for it.
Yes.
It's like
very exciting. And Ljubljana is an amazing place.
Yeah. Axiom is there. The journal Zoom is there. Some of the coolest
couple
thinkers.
Couple hour drive from Venice. If jet fuel still exists, fly out to Europe or within Europe.
Definitely
to
accessible by train, by car.
Hop over to Venice
after. Slovenia is a beautiful country.
To see strange rules.
Yes. So, okay, dialing it back in. We did this crazy installation with Joshua Citarella, and very much thanks to the architecture design studio Sub, specifically Julia Domeniconi and Bill Bellingham and Chris Bloom, and of course, Nicholas Biltin-Czar, where we gathered 500 objects, books, t-shirts, bumper stickers, socks,
nicotine pouches, modafinil,
creatine shorts, mugs, posters. Julian, you made a poster for it.
I made a poster where it has the source code of 4chan, which is based on futaba.php, coded by an anonymous guy in Japan, and then Moot made 4chan, and basically the code responsible for 4chan and all of the things, the protocol that like changed the world via 4chan meme magicking a president into office, et cetera, et cetera. That code is like under 1,000 lines, and the entire thing fits on a poster. So I made this poster, Protocol Weapons of the 21st Century, imagining it like in a museum or something in the future. And it has the entire source code of Futaba printed on the poster.
I mean, I love that poster because I think it does really elegantly prove the point that change the rules and you change the subject. Like a user on 4chan, I mean, you've often talked about it in terms of physics, like the physics of a space. We'll talk more with Josh about the piece, but essentially it's like Venice is this historic merchant city. And we thought, I mean, at first it was just kind of funny. Like, wouldn't it be funny to bring together all the pieces of merch that the Web2 protocol has created? And obviously we can't actually bring together all of the pieces, but we thought we could curate a representative sampling from across the ideological spectrum and show that their objects are quite similar. They're all optimized to flow through a supply chain.
It's almost like the thin material traces of very big consequential abstract social arrangements or something.
Yeah, but I mean, they're also motivating forces. Something that we've been talking about a lot is the representational image versus the operational image. And these t-shirts and mugs and socks and Nalgene bottles or whatever, they are like analog screen space. They're just this advertising space, right? With this powerful image. I mean, the images are stupid seeming, or they're slogans like Alex Jones did nothing wrong. But they, for whatever reason, are powerful enough to actually conduct culture. And taken together, this aggregate of merch ephemera, this is the substrate that has shifted culture. I mean, Josh talks a lot about how 2024 was the podcast election. Like, Trump goes on Alex Jones and a lot of people are swayed by it. This creator protocol, the Web2 creator protocol, is more influential, more potent than any of the legacy media outlets. Mm. And so for us, it was very interesting. Like, what are all these agentic images? They may seem stupid, but the cover of The Dark Enlightenment versus the cover of Ezra Klein's Abundance versus the cover of the new Spike magazine. These are like the images that are propelling us, actually. And we thought in the context of a biennale where you're supposed to have work that is the most substantive or the most powerful, what would it be to show these images? And I think it was really effective. I mean, again, thanks to Sub just very thoughtfully helping us create an infrastructure to show this so that the chaos would stand in relief. But I think it worked.
You know, definitely feel it in a different way when you walk in.
Yeah,
in a way I didn't expect to have actually the objects in front of your eyes and seeing all of the representations of all of these various media outlets and online movements and ideologies and communities.
Yeah, to see them live together. Like, I mean, you would walk into, it felt like, I mean, different people said this, I think Julian, yourself included, it kind of felt like walking into an occult bookstore.
Yeah, in the 90s, like when you were 12, you walk into an anarchist or occult bookstore for the first time and you're like, whoa, what is all this stuff? This feels kind of dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like now you walk into an art bookstore or an independent bookstore and you tend to have, at least on display, you tend to have a relatively narrow range of acceptable independent media. And this tends to skew more to the left. And there's like certain titles, you know, you'll see your Frankfurt School reprints, you'll see your Efflux anointed writers. And this is good. I'm not saying this is bad. But what you don't usually see in a physical bookstore, like an independent bookstore, would be an Alex Jones title or a Peter Thiel title or an Alex Karp title next to like a Tycoon title. You're not going to get those juxtapositions. And somehow all of it becomes at once more valuable when seen in relation to its opposite or its other. And also you see it as a content layer. Like, this is all subservient to the same rules. This is all subservient to the same rules of circulation. And I think that's so interesting. I have to say, it's nice that we got a mention in The Guardian by journalist Eddie Frankel, who did a Venice roundup and called it brilliant, next to Simon Denny's.
Thank you, Eddie Frankel.
But I'm glad that it hit for some people. But I mean, not everyone liked it.
There's these two like people in their late 30s, 40s who came in during the press opening, and the woman walked in and immediately she was just like, nope. And then she pointed at like the Charlie Kirk book and some other MAGA thing and was like, Trump, no thank you, bye. And they walked out immediately. And that was compared to several people came in and were like, I totally get this. I know all of this stuff. I feel so
seen.
So
many people were like, this is my library. Did you raid my closet?
So it's kind of interesting how it operated in these ways of people who have maybe already internalized in a way this kind of protocol framework and understanding of content versus those who haven't, who immediately just engaged with it on this like content level and a kind of like seeing the prohibited pieces of content and immediately being repulsed by them and have to leave
not,
the room
not identifying,
for displaying the symbols in a sacred space of an art institution or something.
I mean, no journalist said this, but I would like to say it ourselves that at many times I felt like we were creating a micro American pavilion.
Yes.
Because I'm like, this is our export. Like, this is our cultural export. And Alma Allen was actually in this year's American Pavilion. And, you know, he's a sculptor from Texas, who I think like lives in Mexico City, just making these large bronze objects. And, you know, in some ways that is the kind of art, like big A art, that this administration like would anoint or produce. And we can like talk about the pavilion if you want to. But in a real talk way, representing all of these occupants of the Web 2 protocol, which is like superficially very political, like it deals in politics and it assigns, you know, an aesthetic. As of course, Simon's work upstairs really dug into, like, what are the aesthetics of this turn towards defense, like Palantir and Anduril and A16Z, and like, how are they self-styling? That's a very interesting vector. Maybe we can have Simon on the show to talk about it further. But in terms of just like, what is America producing? This is what it's producing.
Yeah. And ideologies and protocols.
Within this particular kind of protocol. I'm just to sort of do a Venice roundup. This was your first time to Venice during the Biennale. I'm curious, what were your impressions of going to the Biennale and walking around, and like, what did that feel like to you?
I mean, it's strange that it's very where the pavilions are. It's very much like weird art Epcot Center, because the pavilions are permanent and they all have the country's names on them and like different architecture for each. And they're actually much smaller than I expected.
Well, they're pavilions. They're like, but
nobody knows how big or small a pavilion is.
It's true. They oftentimes look big in the photos.
Yeah. Also, there's the Virginia Beach Pavilion, which is like a 15,000 seat amphitheater.
Oh, you're thinking of like Meriwether Post Pavilion, like these kinds of concert venues.
Yeah. I saw 311 there when I was eighth grade or something.
Okay. Right.
I kind of expected them to be larger, but I don't know. It's also strange because so many friends ours were involved, like, let's go to the Finnish pavilion, and Jenna Zutella is there with their wind monsters.
It's so cool.
A is at the Japan pavilion with his diaper sunglasses babies. There's Lauren and Marco from Discs
curating the Danish pavilion.
Film. Yeah. So, I mean, it was also hard because we were with a kid, and I probably would have, for my first time, actually like spent more time with the artworks.
Right, but one never really sees the art during an opening. It's all about the people.
A lot of chit chat.
Carly.
I suffered much chit chat over this.
My favorite part though was we went in and they were like, your daughter needs a pass. And we're she's two. How are we supposed to get her a pass? She's two. And they were like, well, you'll need to ask one of the pavilions for an official invitation. And I'm like, yeah, like as they're opening, they're going to have time to like give a two-year-old an official. You've got to be kidding me. Luckily, the lady like Coco charmed her, I think, and we were able to go in. But come on. I mean, to be honest, like I have a very official press pass from Germany that I have to like reapply for.
A state,
right, you know, has like a biometric photo on it. And I applied with that and new models and a CV that has a decade plus of art reporting and did not receive a press invitation because I'm not the head of an official magazine. Like all the creators that we represented in the Strange Rules exhibition are just invisible to the very official Biennale apparatus. And I can understand why, but you get this sort of self-reinforcing thing where then the people who cover the Biennale are within the ecosystem of legacy media. And there's some really great reporters in it, but it's like this ossified thing that's very difficult to, I mean, we were able to receive a pass thanks to the pavilion invitations though, right, not thanks to the work we do in media.
Well, I mean, of course, after so much being said about the decay of the art world, you could feel the part of it that's trying to preserve the protocol that it existed over the past, whatever, 70 years.
Yeah.
And those who are actually leaning into something newer, trying to engage with it. Like, right. I think the Danish Pavilion, like, that felt contemporary.
Right. And you want to say what it was?
There was a film and installation by Maya Malou Lisa called Things to Come. Villa Haimala did the music. Curated it, or produced the film, maybe, was involved. Yeah,
she's the youngest artist to have ever shown in the Danish Pavilion.
Yeah, and we were there for the opening of it. There were very cool, fashionable young people present. There were some very tall guys with long hair and flared jeans who were probably in a rock band or were models who look like they're in a rock band. The film was like this saturated, almost like Uncanny Valley, where it's a real film, but something almost feels AI about it because it starred all these
augmented
porn stars who are, yeah, just like extremely smoothly refined and plumped and lasered.
Their actual bodies.
Yes. And interesting that operant images seems to be popping up everywhere too, because they introduced the film. It's basically about, there is some study that shows that, you know, if during sperm collection, the man watches VR porn, it actually increases sperm motility by 50%. So the image is having this like actual biological effect on like little tiny swimming code in your balls, to be clear. So the film imagines this future of operant images and genetics and, well, actually, I didn't see enough of the film to say
but
exactly.
But you get the sense of it. You get the sense of it. And then, yes.
Also, there's a sperm racing footage with the containers that look like heavy-duty film or music equipment flight cases, but they're trapezoidal, which is very
weird.
Because I guess you never have to, like, stack huge amounts of sperm anywhere, so they don't have to compress the space. But
they're
trapezoidal flight cases.
Probably so they don't tip over.
Maybe so. Anyways, they had those cases where they actually ship sperm in these cases.
They had tiny, mini, like Pippolotti wrist style, tiny, tiny screens embedded inside on one half of the pavilion. And on the other half of the pavilion, they had like IMAX style, like full immersion.
Giant curved jumbotrons showing this film.
Which, so you have these massive boobs that are like larger than life or something.
Yes, and like filmed really close and wide angle lenses. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I mean, I'd like to see the whole thing.
And then I think Yana's piece was beautiful. She's thinking about the meteorological situation of Venice and she's harnessing the wind and she animates each wind with a different monster that
she's
like
giant fur.
Yeah, hair.
Quivering, shivering, blowing fur monsters with wild.
Playing these instruments.
Hairstyles,
like the unseen waves. I mean, when I was first hearing about Yana's piece a couple of months ago, it was when we were recording with Daniel Dessoux and Sal Hagen and talking about the shape of vibes and the shape of cascades and network space and making that visible and like what it does when you think about that is visible. And I think to some degree, Yenna is thinking about these waveforms that carry seeds and microbes and pollution and sands and how these kind of invisible forces end up shaping us. And it was a very beautiful piece and that felt good. And then A. Arakawa Nash's Baby Pavilion, which of course, you know, Japan having a population crisis, Germany right. too. And he's like, babies are a reality. They happen, you know, let's think about babies. And you could change a baby's diaper and you could hold the baby and they're actually baby weight.
Yeah.
And it was just a classic fun.
They're like quite literally like training babies.
Right. And like you'd have in like a CPR kind of.
And they also all had sunglasses, which made them look very cool and fun. And
big hit with Coco.
Oh, yeah.
It was great. But the German Pavilion had this trompe l'oeil mosaic that turned the fascist 1938 architecture that the German Pavilion is into a graffiti-laden socialist housing block, which similar, I guess, to the housing block that the artist Sung Tu, she grew up in. And inside was some more of Sung's work as well as Henrika Neumann. She tragically passed away in February, but it showed the interiors of East German life, like in the 90s, the kind of furniture, the curtains, the kind of color palette, like what the aesthetic world is. The subtext being the interior domestic aesthetic world of the rising far right in Germany. Like what kind of aesthetics incubated this kind of political subject.
And then the entire pavilion was covered in mosaic tiles.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Absolutely nuts. Because it is like two or three stories high, the whole thing covered with mosaic tiles. But like, it looked like the concrete facade of an abandoned building, including like graffiti and stains, but like in mosaic.
Yeah.
So you'd have like this kind of like bad graffiti, but like
in the mosaic itself.
In the mosaic tiles themselves to replicate the facade is like really surreal. And just thinking about laying all of them is like
crazy. In any case, it's a very impactful treatment of this pavilion, which itself is like an icon. So to cover it, and I guess the whole exhibition was called Ruin. So it was, you know, thinking about the ruin of the institution that is Germany.
We did not get to see the nude woman jet skiing in circles in the Austrian
Florentina Holzinger
pavilion.
Piece.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I know it was the popular pick. It was called SeaWorld Venice, Live in Your Piss, which I think was like maybe...
Wait, that was the actual
subtitle? That was the title
subtitle?
Of it, SeaWorld Venice, Live in Your Piss. But it was like a female actionist take on... I mean, the image itself of like a nude woman on a jet ski inside the Austrian...
A really small room full of water.
It's a good image, but actually what really bothered me was the text attached with it. It just is so on the nose. I just need to read it. The pavilion is flooded. A jet ski makes its rounds as a monument to the ecological catastrophe driven by turbo tourism, which continues to collide with the sinking city.
Isn't there something else where there's like people's pee is filtered and turned into reclaimed water and then people drink it or something?
Someone's swimming in it all day long. It just felt like...
I mean,
it's really stupid.
I wish there was like a media read or something to the pointless cycling of content consumption and spectacle, right?
Yeah.
But I guess it was a metaphor for turbo tourism
and ecological deterioration. And
yes.
Yeah. It just felt like, I mean, whatever. It felt very Meanwhile in Berlin meme. It just felt like, you know, like that was like the most spoken about. But I felt like it was kind of boring.
I mean, I wonder though, is that just the kind of image you need to travel and break through right now, right? I mean, it's...
Yes, but I mean, yeah. Is it an operational image? Like, yes. But I mean, in our installation, we had a room filled with those kinds of images. Mm. Like every single book cover kind of does that, right? And I think to hold it up as incredibly valuable misses in order of magnitude. Like in itself is still content. And trying to send that content out there with this didactic message of like, see, like that to me feels behind.
I've noticed this a lot though, is that like wall text can be a real problem.
Yeah.
Like just because of AI and the ease of generating corporate speak or HR speak or art speak. It's kind of like there's a new kind of paranoid style of reading, maybe even that I see developing in myself, where it's like certain phrases or words or
affects
or dispositions make me suspicious and distract me and pull me out of the messaging, you know? And what that means for our subjectivity or reading moving forward, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure many people don't feel this way and aren't as guarded against it, but also, you know, something similar will happen or is happening with images too. Yeah. Is this AI or not? Which also becomes the thing I don't like is it's distracting. You know?
But also it's like they're presets. Like actually this there makes are, me though, think, yes. Yeah, like they're these presets, like.
And before AI, they were.
Totally. Exactly. Exactly. But like naked woman on a jet ski is a kind of preset. And I guess I get sus because I'm like, well, of course you can make that image. Like, of course you could do that. As a contrast, what are you thinking?
Of course you can. Anyone can fill a room with water and a naked woman like, jet ski around in circles in it.
No, it's like.
You can do it right now in your home. Do you have an empty room? You can do it today.
I guess it's just like
call up your local YMCA.
No, don't you remember? Did you ever where I grew up, a lot of people had out of ground pools, and you would just get like three kids in one of those out of ground pools making a whirlpool.
Oh yeah,
and you had the fantasy that you could do that in any enclosed space, and that's what it made me think of.
One thing, though, I will say, it may be in defense of the Austrian pavilion work, is that it was dangerous.
Was it?
Of course.
The work for the woman.
Would keep going.
But that's their heritage of actionism. It has to be dangerous.
Yeah, that feels like, it's kind of like, I'm sorry, this is really cynical, but it's kind of like, oh, if the artist is a woman, we can be as edgy and dangerous as we want,
right,
maybe.
If it was a guy going around in a whirlpool.
Be like, oh, this is terrible. Bro, this is just back to like Matthew Barney 2.0 or
totally.
Something.
Totally. I mean, I'd be down for that. But I want Zuck on a hydrofoil going around the Austrian Pavilion.
Naked.
Well, gold chains flapping in the wind.
But anyways, I mean, some of these things, I mean, the Danish pavilion and the Austrian pavilion, at least it shows that people in the art world recognizing the need to generate desire again.
That's true.
Right?
That's true.
Which is something we've been saying.
And definitely.
Dean has been saying, and yes. So
yeah, definitely.
Let's appreciate the effort.
Yes. True.
But then actually, though, now that I think about it, there was something a bit cremaster about the Danish pavilion film as well.
These impossible bodies or
also just the extremely high production value and yes,
kind of like antiseptic,
this kind of like surreal extremity of bodies, like the one, you know, I saw like a few minutes of the film, but there was a person, I believe they didn't have arms, they were non-binary maybe, and they were playing piano with their nipples. Let's be honest, like I think the art world needs this kind of spectacle and desire again. And
definitely.
If there are smart, attractive, and edgy women artists making it and taking it there,
go for it.
Right.
I'm on that camp. I'm in that camp too. I agree.
Needs it. So
I agree. Yes. I agree. Celebrate our human beauty.
We need to celebrate our edgelord women artists.
Okay, fair enough.
Doing big spectacles.
I guess I was going to say, by contrast, it is interesting to think of Trevor Paglen's work for the Strange Rules exhibition, where there's no images. It's an installation where you can be hypnotized. You walk into a neutral spa-like environment. There's like Aesop air diffuser, like it's really
everything is cream.
You're on like a
togo couch lounger
with like knobby, beautiful, I don't know, the textures all feel nice against your skin. It's a full somatic experience, and you
it's very womb-like.
You put on headphones and then you choose from one of, I think...
The placenta scent from Aesop, I believe, right?
I think it was something a little woodier than room, but sure. And you put on headphones and you select via your voice one of, I think, six different experiences, from like experiencing planetary consciousness,
cosmic consciousness
to meeting your future self, to meeting your inner child,
generating novel neural pathways.
right, and then levitating. And is that all
yes.
six, maybe? And so, you know, you're led by a voice.
Also,
into
I think this.
This
was based on the CIA Project Stargate, maybe that's
yeah,
what it's called. Something
I think
it was back when the CIA, they got really spooked because the Soviets were doing an army of psychics. They were trying to train to remote view secret U.S. military installations. And of course, the CIA, they were all dropping acid anyways. And they were like, oh, we need to, before we got to beat the Soviets as psychic remote viewers. So
there
was a period of time where the CIA was really into training psychic remote viewers.
Yeah, and there's actually
it sounds
like
crazy. It's totally true.
Some collages that
I mean that was also incredible
that were like used during that
basically
psychic
they would
training.
Put the guys in the CIA would be sitting there with magazines in the 60s, cutting out pictures from the magazine, but like putting like a raccoon head on a bikini model with like a pack of cigarettes next to it and a baby crawling out of the pack of cigarettes, and they
like
would put
the
that in the room.
Yeah. Yeah, and like in the right. In
and the
room,
reason
yeah.
they made it is because they needed. Needed something like very unusual and strange in the room the psychic was supposed to remote view to prove that they could see it,
yeah.
right? So they had to put some bizarre thing so that the psychic couldn't bullshit what the room looked like. They'd have to be like, oh no, there's a picture in the room of a raccoon woman and a baby crawling out of a pack of cigarettes, right?
Yeah, it's like this, like, so
a form of like psychic encryption or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully we can speak with Trevor a bit about this show.
Yes,
he also
did
has a new,
it.
Yeah, I did the hypnosis. Yeah, he also has a new book out, which I highly recommend, which has a new intro, but are his collected essays over the past several years and read together. He was really onto this like a decade ago. He's been like thinking about operational versus representational images for a while.
I mean, that's like a theme this year, I feel
yeah,
like.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of people yeah. are thinking about that. Like,
But Trevor's book is fantastic. And it's crazy how early he was.
Yeah, with, he was been thinking about this since this the beginning. Stuff. But so the show, you walk in and you choose a hypnosis track, and then you're led by a voice to have this experience. Of course, the images come to your mind through voice. So it's like this neo-oral experience where, like, basically you're prompted
right.
to think of certain images, and it has like an emotional component, you know.
But that's in it, but that's the most interesting. That's the most interesting.
It made me cry.
That is the most interesting yeah. part, because we prioritize the visual so much, but you can have a more intense emotional affective response to something that's just only audio than any image you
totally.
Encountered in the pavilions, right?
Well, like, there's the Vatican Pavilion. Again,
also,
shout out to the Holy See. Shout out to the Vatican, who has
generational
this,
run.
I mean, really great. Hans Ulrich Obrist curated this pavilion along with Ben Vickers and the Soundwalk Collective. And it's in this beautiful, it's called like the Mystical Garden or
the Mystic Garden.
The Mystic Garden. It's like a Carmelite convent?
I think it was started by St. Teresa of Avila, maybe.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know. There's
just
seven
stunning
monks who live there. It's a beautiful garden.
Walled garden right next to
the main train station
in Venice. And so you're just in this oasis of calm when you're surrounded by all this chaos. And it's visual only in the sense that you see the garden as you walk, but you wear a headset that is like geo-tagged to perfectly blend into different sonic.
It really precisely knows your location.
Right.
And every section of the garden has a different artist. There's Laraji and Jim Jarmusch and Callie Malone and Matt and Holly and Dev Hines and FK Twigs and Patti Smith.
Yeah.
And there's also certain, if you sat on a particular stump, you would start to hear a poetry reading, and everything crossfades in and out kind
perfectly.
Of perfectly. I mean, all the music is rather ambient, not so rhythmic, so you don't have shoes in the dryer, DJ train wrecks. And I think everything also is all inspired by or built around Hildegard von Bingen.
Again,
generational run for Hildegard von Bingen. But everything seamlessly crossfades as you walk from one section to the other. Really, really beautiful and well-executed piece.
Yeah, it's
right?
like a full sensory experience.
That's the thing. I mean, also, like, because the internet is primarily visual, we tend to forget
right.
overweight its power.
I mean, it's kind of like when you're in the supermarket, all of these vegetables in America are optimized for how they look, but not right. how they taste, right?
Right,
I mean,
totally.
Like similar, or how they smell. Or, but anyway, that's our Venice roundup. I hope we do speak more with Josh about some of the themes in Strange Rules itself. And again, I think we'll hopefully speak with Simon and also Trevor and Matt and Holly over the coming months to talk about their specific works, because there is something that's brewing there with this idea that art is more than just the image. Art is more than just the content layer. It's something that is manifestly happening at the rules level. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's also wonderful musicians and artists who are making work at what we keep saying somewhat pejoratively is the content layer. For instance, we also just recorded a conversation with Stephen Warwick, who put out two albums this year, and his work is like meant to be listened to together with friends in a club. And that is content layer art in a sense, but it's not, because it's not supposed to circulate disembodied. It's supposed to be
right. I mean, is it content if you're consuming it collectively in an environment? I don't think so. I think content also kind of is like
disembodied,
an isolated,
exactly.
disembodied thing you consume.
That's a really important point. I think the reason a lot of people are like, what is protocol art? That sounds like a scam. What is this? And I think like you only have the term protocol art when you have so much quote art consumed as PDFs, content. JPEGs, content, part of the stream. So you say this in order to re-include the entire physics layer, the structure, and also the receiving end
into it. I mean, it's also
a call to action
to engage with this layer, right?
Yeah, like, make better protocols. Think about them. Yes. Like, don't take them for granted.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I think that's in part what it is.
I think to close this
part.
Brief roundup, though, of our last couple weeks, really, because there was so much prep. What did we do after Venice?
So flights home to Berlin were like crazy expensive and at inopportune times. So we thought we were so smart. We would fly out of Bergamo and we would stay a couple nights in Lake Garda, specifically.
In Gardone Riviera.
And what is at Gardone Riviera?
Il Vittoriale.
What is
home
Il Vittoriale?
Of Gabriel D'Annunzio.
And who is Gabriel D'Annunzio?
Well, some say he's a proto-fascist, but he was a Italian decadent era writer and poet, like late 19th century, early 20th century, international playboy. He was kind of just like a huge celebrity in Europe and also a war hero during World War I. I think in 1914, he flew a plane by himself over Austria and dropped 10,000 propaganda pamphlets.
I mean, 1914,
returned.
Flying a plane by yourself. Like, right. When were planes, like, when were the Wright brothers?
5 years after,
yeah. Like, so
I mean,
flying a plane in 1914 is pretty...
Yes, crazy. And then he went on this expedition with 5,000 of his legionnaires to the city of Fiume and took it over without a shot fired.
Modern-day Rijeka, right?
Right. And then for
Croatia.
2 years had this, like, wild, free city-state where the constitution of the country named music its highest value and women could vote. It had universal suffrage and kind of became this magnet for all of these artists and eccentrics, and it was just this 2 years of making a fantasy society real. It was kind of like this anarcho-syndicalist organization where everyone was represented by guilds, and then the guilds debated what the policy should be for the government. And there was even a guild for like artists and people who produced life, you know, and eventually it all fell apart. But during this experiment, D'Annunzio would do these big theatrical speeches from balconies and had all of this really aestheticized the politics in the city.
He was sort of LARPing, like, what would it be? That was also just like the standard back then. The kings and the leaders would stand on balconies and look to a crowd, because this is like before radio, right? So this is like at a time when that's how you addressed a mass. And he was really like, it's my understanding, playing it up as like a decadent. Like, how would a decadent do this? It wasn't that he wanted the power necessarily. It was that he wanted to make it as over the top decadent, not in a Trumpian way, in like a oligopolist way.
Turning life into theater.
Right.
Yes. And
People loved it.
Yes, people loved
it. Qui contra nos. His tagline was,
who is against
who
us?
Who could be against us?
Just qui contra nos. And so Mussolini, though, borrowed some of the aesthetic innovations.
Well, D'Annunzio was not such a fan of Mussolini. He was actually quite saddened.
D'Annunzio really disliked fascism. Right. He hated Hitler. He really thought Mussolini just made a grotesque mockery of Italy and what Italian culture represented. But he was also such a celebrity in Italy that Mussolini couldn't get rid of him. I think the quote from Mussolini is, D'Annunzio is a bad tooth. So what do you do with a bad tooth? You either remove it or cover it in gold. And right. So because D'Annunzio was so beloved in Italy, he covered him in gold. And basically, D'Annunzio had this internal exile on Lake Garda to this massive villa that D'Annunzio then kind of made this...
augmented with his architect over years.
Built an amphitheater. And yes...
All these follies and dales, as they're called.
Dales of crazy water, insane water.
Yeah,
and had this
just a
battleship installed.
Right, actual World War One battleship.
Hillside.
Like, how they got that up there, no idea.
It is so wild. And then inside is all of this Eastern art and all of this classical plaster casts from Michelangelo and all this, like, Art Nouveau, Belle Epoque stuff. And it's just filled with books and strange, beautiful objects. So it was kind of this gilded cage for D'Annunzio during this time. And D'Annunzio also, I guess...
which is like the 1930s. This is when Italy was being led by Mussolini, but before Germany had invaded
And also early on, like, D'Annunzio really tried to prevent Mussolini from entering into a pact with Hitler.
Right.
But they kind of... it didn't work. And D'Annunzio also was... cocaine addict from Fiume on, and they just kind of kept him
drugged up in
this like
crazy
palace, you know, kept throwing money at him to do whatever weird projects he wanted to do. But anyways, the house is there. You can visit it. D'Annunzio is still really this mythic figure in Italy. Although people in the West try to say he invented fascism or whatever. I mean, in a weird way, it's like, I don't know how politics operates without aesthetics anymore due to social media.
Interesting thing, though, about looking at D'Annunzio's aesthetic, which is very much this Art Nouveau. I mean, he sort of shares something with Klimt. Like, he's of this new kind of human that is living more in their head than rooted to the earth. And he has a huge fantasy, and it's very impractical. It's not like the functionalism of Italian futurism. It's like the opposite of a kind of Marinetti. I mean, it seemed like it would add friction to any kind of speed. It was like a slow walk through all of this brocade and objects and books. And
D'Annunzio famously believed the automobile was female, which I think is opposed to Marinetti's
Of speed and male. Right, I guess there's the key, right. But I mean, what I think we didn't really realize, which became apparent when we got to Gardone Riviera, is that this was kind of like the Hamptons for the German Nazis. Like, for many years.
After D'Annunzio died, it's kind of sick irony. The next town over, Salò, famous for the film Salò, which is an adaptation of 120 Days of Sodom, during this period of the Italian Social Republic, which is basically Italy surrendered to the Allies. Germany was really mad about that. They came in and
took over
and invaded Italy and started a puppet state headquartered on Lake Garda.
And actually had Mussolini in a palace in a neighboring city along Lake Garda, where he also was somewhat
puppet leader. But yeah, we get there and every single building, every single hotel, there's a sign out front like, during the Italian Social Republic, this was the headquarters of convalescence for the German Wehrmacht military police. It's like every single, so it's a very, very strange place.
Yeah.
But also very beautiful. Lots of empty villas, like incredible Art Nouveau. In Italy, it had a different name, but basically these insane Art Nouveau villas.
And there's like, there are multiple five-star hotels.
These five-star hotels, you can tell for like an aging, like a dying class of tourists.
Yes.
Like German boomers, Italian boomers.
There are not a lot of people in our age range or Coco's age range. But
anytime we passed someone who was under 50, they like clocked us.
But there was actually the people who lived there. There was like this
very gummo,
such a
Euro-gummo
such a
coated,
wild...
very strange characters yeah. living there too.
Because we just decided, because we didn't have a car, so we decided just to walk from Salo to right. Garden of Riviera and then up and through the hills or whatever. And yeah, but, very beautiful,
actually,
very bizarre.
I actually kind of recommend it though to people. I mean, the Il Vittoriale is...
Il Vittoriale is stunning. Maybe don't bring your toddler. Definitely not the most toddler-friendly place
also,
on planet
not
Earth.
A very walking-friendly place, surprisingly.
Yeah, but, it's like really crazy cars and like party motorcycles, as Coco called them. And really steep hills, which are like, the hills aren't, being steep isn't a problem. It's just they're like narrow with insane motorbikes without sidewalks. So it's a bit harrowing to be walking after a few glasses of wine with a stroller at night. But anyway, we all survived. We're all back here.
But maybe I'm just literally talking shit right now because I've happened to be a D'Annunzio fan for a very long time. But, you know, I wonder if there's a lesson there of how progressive or left movements in the U.S. particularly can get some vitality
back,
and excitement
desire back.
Desire back, right?
There was no room for someone jet skiing in the D'Annunzio Palace, but you know, you could imagine that within the world.
He would. Anyway.
All right. Maybe that's all for content today. Maybe content tomorrow. We open a new page.
Content tomorrow, yes.
No, I do want to talk to Josh and a lot more discussion of content.
Like, content. Got a content.
A lot of content coming. We also have some video of the show that we might share with you either on this short episode or we just have to see what we do with Josh.
Right. Yes. Josh has joined the content royalty, I'd say.
I think so too.
Knighted in the realm of content.
I mean, really learned so much though, like how important it is as an artist to have ready-made sound bites so that when someone walks through, you can, for instance, explain to a pair of septuagenarian French women why we have a shirt on the wall that says Hikikomori condition. Like, what does that mean?
Right.
And he's very good at understanding how to communicate to a wider audience. And I have a lot of respect for
that. I cannot express to you how damaging my idea of what being an artist or creative person would be like, thinking that you just intuitively flow through every situation.
D'Annunzio style.
And it all falls together. That's not at all how it works.
Right. But even D'Annunzio was like very conscious of his reception. And there was like, you knew he was writing letters for his posthumous re-exhibition.
Yes. Yeah, and he knew you have to get in the plane and do the crazy thing and do the work. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for content today. See you tomorrow and see you
next episode.
All right. Ciao.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Content Today, and thank you Denmark, Finland, and Japan for granting us Giardini access. We've got a backlog now of New Models interview episodes almost ready to release that we can't wait to drop. We'll be rolling them out in the coming weeks. In the meantime, our work with Joshua Citarella, the online marketplace of ideas, is on view at Venice's Palazzo Dieto through October. A big thanks to the many people in the New Models and Do Not Research community who contributed work to this piece, and of course to Elena Zagas for all of her help navigating the real Internet of Things. We'll be sharing more documentation soon. Also, a quick note to say that we're working on an IRL event happening in Berlin the evening of Sunday, June 21st, and something else on June 23rd. It's going to be a busy solstice. More on that soon. That's all for now. Thanks again, and see you next episode.
Production edited by Carly Busta. Mixing, sound design.